Welcome to the Overshare Show. I'm Tony, and today we're going to be talking about the biological clock, which basically means that as a woman, you have an expiration date on your lady parts. So once your body has squirted out all its eggs, your baby-making days are over. And I find this to be an incredibly interesting topic to discuss because most of my life I have spent trying not to get pregnant. I mean, I cannot tell you how many times I've sat on the toilet staring at my stained underwear, thanking Jesus I got my period. And then you do want to get pregnant. And I don't think I'm alone in this conundrum. You spend a lot of time not wanting to get pregnant, and then suddenly you do. And for modern women, we have a variety of different ways to control our fertility. You know, we have condoms, we have diaphragms, which kind of freak me out because I don't really like the idea of fishing them out of me. And we also have birth control pills, which I think are about 98% effective. But the problem with birth control pills is that they release hormones into your body. And I had never really thought about this. I started taking birth control when I was 15 because I was obviously having sex too young. And I just never questioned it. My mom was the one who put me on the pill. And, you know, you don't really question what your mom does. I never thought about how it would affect my health or future fertility. It just never occurred to me. And then one day when I was about 25, I was in Jamba Juice with one of my organic hippie moon goddess tribal friends. We were sitting in Jamba Juice and we were talking about our lives and our sex lives and partners and stuff. And I had mentioned that I was on birth control pills and she was shocked. And she was saying, Tony, I can't believe it. And you care about natural things and you're on the pill and you could get cancer from being on the pill. And it had never occurred to me. I mean, maybe I thought I would be skinnier if I didn't take birth control, but I never thought I was putting myself in any danger. And right when we were having this conversation, in walked this like tiny man into Jamba Juice, and he wasn't wearing any shoes, and he was adorned with these robes, and I'm pretty sure he was carrying a staff. And he came up to me in the middle of this, and he just knocked on my hand. He just knocked my hand and then turned around and left. And from that moment forward, I stopped taking the pill. I was like, I think that's a sign from the universe. So I didn't get my period for 2 years, which is maybe crazy that I didn't look into that, but I was more like, hey, I'm not getting my period. This is also amazing. So after about 2 years, I finally went to the doctor, and the doctor said to me, well, this is concerning. Maybe we should do an MRI because you might have a brain tumor, which seemed crazy. But eventually I did get an MRI, and I did have a brain tumor in my pituitary. Now, I'm not going to blame the pill exclusively, but I would say that the fact that I did take birth control pills, which directly impact your pituitary for so long, that it could have had a consequence, therefore manifesting this tumor. Now, the doctors told me I would never be able to have children. And that's kind of a lot to handle, as I think I was 26 or 27, the idea that I would never be able to have kids. But at the same time, at that point in my life, I also didn't want kids. You know, so I was never going to have them, but I also didn't want them at that moment. So emotionally, I didn't really know how to process this information. And there was also this part of me that didn't believe him, that just said, I'm going to figure it out. So my plan to deal with this brain tumor, rather than going the medical route of taking hormones, which was what the suggestion was, because I couldn't get it operated on, because it was attached to my hypothalamus, and I didn't want to take more hormones because that seemed really counterintuitive, I just said to myself, I'm going to heal holistically. So I don't know. I went on a raw food diet. I saw Reiki practitioners. I went to all sorts of healers. I did sound therapy. I saw psychics. I went to a lot of different medicine men. I drank ayahuasca. And then eventually I did this 10-day silent meditation retreat, And I really feel like that kind of solidified these years of healing work that I had done. And eventually I did get pregnant. And then when I was pregnant, the doctors told me, this is very dangerous. You're a high-risk pregnancy. You may have major problems during your pregnancy or birth that could result in death. You could die from this because your pituitary swells when you're pregnant, when you're in labor. And so I decided that I was going to ignore that also. And I just went to kind of a small hospital in the country town I live in now. And I was fine. But I am really lucky, and I have a lot of empathy and compassion for women who have struggled with their fertility. And today we're going to be talking to a woman named Tanya Silvaratnam, who wrote a book called The Big Lie. And she basically is talking about her personal experience of feeling somewhat lied to about this idea that women can have it all and they don't need to worry about their fertility at a younger age. And eventually when she turned 37 and started trying to get pregnant, she was having many problems and doing IVF. And, you know, she'll tell you more of her personal story and it's in the book. But this idea that women are being lied to about the window of their fertility is really interesting. And she also brings in the concept of feminism a lot and how, okay, having options about your fertility is ultimately a feminist agenda. And that's a beautiful thing. And within this perception that we have time, there's also the sacrifice that we wait too long. And I mean, for me, feminism has a lot to do with equality between men and women, right? But when you think about birth and when you think about fertility, there is no equality between men and women. Like I was saying before, women have a set date. You know, after they release all their eggs, that's it. They don't have more eggs. That's just done. But men produce sperm until the day they die. I mean, granted, you don't necessarily want old man sperm to impregnate you and to procreate with, but it's still a possibility. And then when you think about birth and pregnancy and breastfeeding, I mean, these all happen to women. They don't happen to men. So to search for equality in this biological reality is almost counterintuitive because there is a biological inequality, right? I mean, women and men are biologically different when it comes to babies. So how do we search for equality within this situation? And I mean, Tanya talks about this, is that the idea of searching for infrastructural equality, you know, systemic equality, because biologically there is always going to be this difference. So, I mean, I think that the main thing that we want to do as humans is be really open and honest about the conversation regarding our fertility because, you know, in modern times, women do want to work more or they have to work more because of their specific circumstance. We're not getting married off at 14 and pumping out babies our whole lives. We have many more options than we did in the past, but with that, we still have to be aware that we have a window of our fertility. And if having a baby is important to you, you don't want to miss out on that. So I really hope you enjoy the conversation that I had with Tanya because I found it to be incredibly interesting and fascinating and enjoy. Today we're with Tanya Silvaratnam, author of her new book, The Big Lie, subtitle Motherhood, Feminism, and the Reality of the Biological Clock. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So one of the things that really struck me about your title was this idea of motherhood and feminism. Do you feel like there is an inherent tension between being a mother and being a feminist?
Well, I don't blame feminism at all for what I refer to as the big lie. If anything, I feel that feminism and its liberating messages dovetailed perfectly with advances in reproductive science around the time that I was growing up to create this atmosphere in which women thought that their biologies were more within their controls. I mean, the language of the biological clock has been around for decades. It's just that there are many conflicting and confusing messages out there. So one of my goals is try and reconcile the messages of feminism with the language of the biological clock. And it's not that feminism told us not to become mothers. It told us all the other things that we could do. So this tension between motherhood and feminism, I feel like it's a false tension, and I feel like we need to reset the conversation.
I really like that distinction that you mentioned. And what I would love to talk to you about is this idea, why did you call the book The Big Lie? Did you feel like you were lied to?
Well, I explore many big lies in the book, and there are the lies that we are conditioned to believe, and there are the lies that we tell ourselves. Mm. So in each of those situations, the things that I refer to as the big lies, I ask, was it a lie or a willing deception? Because I feel like some of the responsibility does fall on our shoulders. So one of the big lies that I explore is that we can delay motherhood until we're ready. And if we're not able to get pregnant naturally, then science will make it possible for us. Another big lie is that we can manipulate evolution. You know, with improvements in healthcare and dermatology and cosmetic surgery, et cetera, people really think that we can control our internal clocks. But the truth is, like, our eggs are not following. They're aging at the same rate that they were decades ago. So that's another big lie that I explore. And a major big lie that I explore is that we don't need feminism anymore, which goes back to like your first question. Like, I feel we need feminism more than ever. And I travel a lot. I'm originally from Sri Lanka. I grew up in California in an immigrant community, and I live now in New York. And I feel like if you travel enough and you look at other cultures, you see how important it is to still have feminism to be this framework within which you can argue and advocate for women's freedoms and equality.
In your travels, have you seen that women across the globe are facing these same issues with fertility, or is it more concentrated in America?
Well, one of the criticisms that I find myopic and false is that these issues that I talk about in the book are just rich white women's issues.
Right.
Or that it's like an urban yuppie issue. And I think that is absolutely untrue. Infertility and delaying motherhood are issues that concern women and men all across the globe. And when you look at the statistics, I mean, infertility is on the rise in countries in Africa, in countries in Asia. I mean, India has one of the highest rates of infertility increase, and some of that is due to delaying motherhood. Some of it is due to economics. Some of it is due to environmental factors, pollution, etc., that are causing infertility. So we have to really frame this in terms of it being a global concern. And one of the chapters that I have in the book is called The Global Landscape of Infertility, where I look exactly at how these issues cut across geographic and socioeconomic lines.
I mean, what was one of the things that you found most shocking in that specific part of your research, or that surprised you the most?
Well, one of the things that surprised me the most, and also I found fascinating and bizarre, were the measures that some countries are going to deal with these issues. Some of them are quite extreme. Singapore, which has among the lowest fertility rates in the world, it's somewhere between like 0.75 and 1.15, depending on which research, which data you look at. So in a country like Singapore, they actually have these incentives of paying people cash bonuses to have children.
Wow.
And there are also very, you know, interest-friendly loans that are offered in some other countries to encourage people to have children.
Wow. And why did you feel like people weren't having children in those countries? Was it a choice, or were they naturally having problems?
Well, if you look at the statistics and the reasons that people don't have children, the reasons are so various that it's impossible to say it's because of this or it's because of that. There are economic factors, there are biological factors, there are lifestyle factors. So there are many, many different issues. And I think that we can't separate the pursuit of parenthood from the economics of it.
Right.
Like, for instance, in America, the U.S. Department of Agriculture released figures in 2012 that showed it costs around $235,000 to raise a child for the first 17 years. If you factor in infertility or adoption costs, etc., the costs go through the roof, and most people can't see having a child as a financially feasible pursuit. So we have to, in addition to improving sex education and improving insurance for infertility coverage, I also feel like we have to support people, women and men, more financially and infrastructurally in their pursuit of parenthood. And that involves guaranteed parental leave, more flexible time at work, subsidized childcare, tax credits for infertility treatments, etc.
I mean, I think it's so interesting, these suggestions that you're making seem so rational and reasonable, and yet this is something we've been fighting for and seems almost outside of the spectrum of possibility, because it baffles me that this isn't already happening, how we have such a short maternity leave here in the country, how paternity leave is, maybe it happens, maybe you're afforded it, maybe you're not, and there is no subsidized childcare. And I'm just wondering of the economics behind that. It's like if the CEOs can get paid, you know, 700 times more than the average worker, how come they can't fit in a reasonable and rational childcare policy?
Well, you can apply what you're saying to almost all of the world's problems that plague our societies. You know, there's no reason for kids to be going hungry. There's no reason for people not to learn how to read and write. But these are the realities we're dealing with. And, you know, I personally feel guilty every day that I live in a relative comfort, but there are most people around the world who don't have the basic comforts. My book is my attempt to make more sense of what I think is a very illogical world. Like, we have set up the systems that enslave us, and we have set up the ecosystems that threaten us. So how do we join together to curb and alleviate some of the suffering? And I'm hopeful that the constituency around these issues that I talk about, specifically the pursuit of parenthood and the choices that people have to make during the course of their lifetimes with regard to education, career, and parenthood, I'm hopeful that my book helps spark discussion and debate, and that that discussion and debate will lead to more advocacy for policy changes. And I'm not the only one who's writing about this. There are many, many people out there who are, and I do feel like our numbers are growing.
I mean, if you think about it in terms of a pendulum, you had this, you know, moment in the 50s where the women were at home and they were in the kitchen and they were popping out babies like hotcakes. And then that swung the other direction with the 70s and the feminist movement, where it's like, no, women, you can be working and you should be pursuing these same goals as the men have. And you mentioned in the book, the system is set up for men. It's not necessarily set up for women. So any woman who has ambition and drive and is trying to, you know, pursue her career, taking time out to be a mother is a major sacrifice. And so how have you reconciled that in your own heart? And in the interviews that you've done, have you been seeing that as a common theme or problem that women are having?
Absolutely. And we can't ignore the role that men play in this too. One of my goals with the book is that people embrace the various choices that other people make, whether to have kids or not, because I do feel like we are constantly pitching ourselves against the judgment and expectations of others, and that just sets us up for disappointment or failure.
Yeah.
I also want people to embrace the multiple ways in which people build families, and that involves single parenthood, adoption, unconventional cohabitation agreements, so that we just recognize there is no set path anymore. It's not like in the 50s where people really did do things at very specific time points. You know, the next book I want to write is about reframing the midlife crisis for the 21st century, because I feel like we're living longer now. We don't do things at the same points that our parents and the parents before did. Like, how do we think about these crucial passages in our lives?
I mean, it's funny. I had my kid when I just turned 30, and I honestly felt like a teen mom. I was like, oh, everyone must feel so sorry for me.
Oh, yeah. Now I look at my friends who are in their early 30s after writing the book. I used to think they were so young. Now I say, you know, are you thinking about this?
Right.
Because you don't want to go through what I and, you know, what so many women are going through.
And you do talk a lot about your personal story in the book. Could you tell us a little bit about that? Like, what happened with you? What was your trajectory?
Well, I want people to read the book, because
say too much.
I won't say too much, because there are a lot of shocks. But in a nutshell, I got the idea for writing the book after my third miscarriage, which was in fall 2011. And I had no idea how my personal story would evolve. When I started writing the book, I decided to pursue fertility treatments. And so I went from having three miscarriages to being an infertility patient. And then I was diagnosed with two different types of cancer during the course of the process of pursuing IVF, and was thrown on a completely different track. So I went from the fertility center to the cancer center. And then there were a lot of things that happened after that. So I hope people read the book, because it's definitely a page turner.
It is definitely a page turner. I highly suggest it. And I mean, I have to say, telling your story and being open and honest is obviously an incredibly brave thing to do and puts you in a place of vulnerability. Was that hard for you to tell your story? And, you know, did you struggle with that? Have other women been telling you their story? Have you felt camaraderie and support?
I actually found that the more research I did, the easier it was to tell my story, because I realized I was not alone.
Mm.
And I was so glad that I started doing the research and started talking to people about my story, because I felt like I became part of a community. Now that the book has come out, I see why some people thought it was brave, because there are people who are waiting to pounce on any woman who puts herself out there.
Oh, especially in this subject.
I mean, that's a whole book that can be written.
Yeah.
But I think because I know I'm part of a community, because I know the statistics tell me I am far from alone, and also because of what I went through in my pursuit of parenthood, it has given me kind of a thick skin to withstand the attacks that I might get around this book, because the book ultimately is to give people ideas for how to have more agency in their own lives and how to advocate for some of these measures that really can improve our societies. So I'm very focused on the goals of the book, and the personal attacks I'm okay with.
So when you say that you feel like you're not alone, why is there such a disconnect between people's understanding of their own fertility and the lives that they're living? I mean, do you feel like this is more of a modern thing, or this has been the reality for quite some time? We just had different access to birth control. Like, where do you feel like this began?
It's hard to pinpoint an exact beginning, because these are cultural evolution factors that develop over a long period of time. I think that as women's paths became more various, when they didn't just get married off to someone and then knocked up very quickly, when they could pursue higher education and careers, and motherhood was not the thing they pursued immediately after coming of age, then I think these issues started to become more prevalent. And what's happening is that my generation, meaning the generation that's, you know, in our late 30s and 40s now, really was the guinea pig generation for testing the limits of our fertilities. And I think why I realize I'm not alone is that it really is my generation that is hitting our 40s, realizing that maybe we waited too long, and how could we have done things differently? So what I'm hoping is that by sharing my mistakes, I'm able to inspire others to make better decisions about their own futures. There really is no set solution, too, because one of the things I write about in the book is how women have had to fit into a world that was largely scheduled and structured around men and men's needs. So we have to look at both macrocosmic changes and also microcosmic changes. And there are changes that we can advocate for at large, and there are changes that we can take within.
Right, like the small changes. Like, even if you are a mother, it doesn't mean you have to do 100% of the work. If you have a partner, that should be more shared. And I do think there is a gendered aspect to parenting where the mother takes a much larger role in responsibility. So she's not only working a job, but then she's working at home. And that inequality, I think, affects women's interest or have in having children, or wanting to have more children, or trepidation in general, because you think of it as a sacrifice too. Like, oh, I'm going to have to give up a lot.
Absolutely. And one of the points I make in the book is that we have to ask for what we need. We can't expect it to be given to us. We have to ask for what we need in the workplace, and we have to ask for what we need at home. And we have to ask for knowledge, too, because I really believe knowledge is power, and I feel like a lot of the suffering happens because we don't have adequate, accurate, and widespread knowledge. There are a couple of comments that I've seen around the book saying, I knew all about this stuff. I can't believe she didn't. Where did she go to school? But the reality is, when you look...
I went to Harvard, thank you.
And did you know all the basics about your fertility when you were growing up? Like, did you know how long about the number of eggs you had at different stages? Did you know about the statistics of when your fertility starts to decrease sharply?
No, I definitely didn't. And I mean, I've only recently been like, oh, I guess 35 is a magic age. I mean, did you find that most women know, or there is a huge gap?
I found that most women didn't know.
Yeah.
And there's this magical thinking that some people have where they really believe that if they knew, then other women must know.
Right.
Or if it worked out for their friend to delay motherhood and have kids, then it can work out for a lot of other women.
Right.
But the truth is, every woman is different, and all our experiences are different, and all our educations are not the same. So like in my case, I went to a Christian elementary school in East Los Angeles. I had one session of sex education where I was taught how babies were made. I was taught nothing about my fertility span.
Right.
So I really think we have to overhaul sex education, because I do believe knowledge is power, and I feel like we should start thinking about our fertilities when we're learning how to prevent pregnancies and STDs.
I mean, and something you bring up in the book that I wanted to talk about is also the role of the media. So, you know, let's say even if you were aware, it's harder to get pregnant at 35, but, you know, Halle Berry's pregnant, or this, all these other women, or Jennifer Aniston's going to be pregnant because she's pregnant every week on the tabloids. I mean, even if you know it might be harder, there's also this feeling, it's almost like getting an STD. That's not going to happen to me. You know, so yeah, maybe it'll be harder, but it'll work out for me like it does for these other women. So I do think there are all these examples in the media of success. And so how do you feel like that is affecting, you know, women's understanding of their own fertility?
Well, Barbara Ehrenreich, the great feminist author, has written about how we prefer positive spin to the reality.
Right.
And I have a chapter in my book called Baby Madness in the Media, where I look at different celebrities and tabloid and news stories and how they spin fertility. And it's a confusing landscape. You can't say it's one way or another, because you do have people like Halle Berry and Kelly Preston seemingly getting pregnant without any difficulty in their mid to late 40s. But then you see people like Brooke Shields and Celine Dion and Hugh Jackman and his wife Deborah Lee Furness being very open about the struggles they went through. We have these messages out there, the realities and the unknowns. How do we parse through that information? And I think that in general, it's very hard for people to accept the negative. We still aspire to the fantasy. But I'm hopeful that by people sharing their stories more, that we will balance the optimistic scenarios with the heartbreaking ones. The truth is that baby making for anyone is a very private and intimate matter. They're under no obligation to tell us how they did it.
Right.
So celebrities don't have to tell us how they made their kids. But they should also be aware that because they're in the public eye and they're being written about, that the message they put out there can sway public opinion. I mean, there are people who say, you know, nobody thinks that because Kelly Preston got pregnant when she was 47, 48, that they will too. But I think that's myopic as well. People need to acknowledge that popular culture is a very important facet of our society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it shapes perspective and it shapes possibility.
It shapes public discourse.
Yeah.
Maybe not for, you know, overly educated, privileged people but you know, I'm saying that wrong, but like I think there is this magical thinking that people know what's fact and fiction.
Right.
And I know that even with my education, I didn't always know what was fact and fiction because I wasn't given the accurate facts about my fertility.
And I think that's the thing about, I mean, you were saying this beforehand, being a willing participant in believing a lie, is that when you have these examples, it's like people use the example about racism. They're like, there's no racism. Oprah is rich and Obama is president.
Right.
You know, so you have these like very specific and selective exceptions. And then that is just like blasted as, oh, well, this is obviously how it can be. So the fantasy becomes almost a standard, even though systemically that's just not the case. And so I feel like there is a certain responsibility of like promoting this idea, you know, like through the media that, hey, I was actually super lucky. And I also had like $9 million to throw into this effort or whatever. I mean, do you know the actual statistical rates of how successful IVF is so people can get an idea of what they're actually dealing with?
Well, as many as 77% of IVF cycles worldwide fail. And you have to consider that in the U.S., for example, an IVF cycle costs somewhere between $10,000 and $20,000 per cycle. And it usually takes multiple cycles for a successful pregnancy, if you have a successful pregnancy. So those numbers are not encouraging.
Yeah. And I think that's really important that people wrap their head around that. I mean, it's a great science as a possibility, but it shouldn't be.
It's not a guarantee.
And I almost feel like it's marketed as a guarantee.
Yes, and I think some people want to blame the medical profession, but again, as with the argument around feminism, I really feel like these factors dovetailed at a time when we were looking for better paths than the ones we had been given. And advances in reproductive science and the liberating messages of feminism made it possible for us to delay motherhood. But now we're realizing that science can't work miracles. And, you know, reproductive science, infertility is a big industry. It tops $4 billion a year in the U.S. And I was reading a report just this week that the global IVF industry is projected to top $20 billion by the year 2020. There's a lot of money being made. Not all of those people pursuing infertility treatments are people who've delayed motherhood. There are, of course, people dealing with infertility at any age in the spectrum. But women in large numbers who've delayed motherhood do pursue IVF, because they're having difficulty, they're having more difficulty getting pregnant and also carrying to term, because the rates of miscarriage go up, especially after you hit 40.
I mean, those numbers are actually pretty staggering. And when you met with your doctor, you know, were they ever talking to you like, hey, Tanya, are you thinking about babies? Was there a conversation that happened that you ignored, or did you never even feel like it was part of the conversations you had with your...
My OBGYNs and my general practitioners never, ever talked to me about my fertilities. And I went and interviewed a bunch of friends and just strangers that I met and asked them if their doctors talked to them proactively. And it was a mixed bag.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of my goals for the book, is to stop this mixed bag of information so that everyone gets accurate information. You know, there was this study by the Yale University School of Medicine, Dr. Jessica Iluzzi, that came out just this month, January 2014, in the journal Fertility and Sterility, which showed that the majority of women, as high as 90%, do not know the basic facts about their fertilities and how baby making works.
That's a huge percentage.
It's staggering.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of research to find out what are the statistics on fertility awareness, and found that every survey from Resolve, the National Infertility Association, from the Fertility Centers of Illinois, every survey, and most of these surveys deal with various geographic locations and socioeconomic groups, all of them show that there is a serious gap in people's fertility awareness.
Do you think that part of that is an uncomfortability that there is about talking about it? I mean, I know there's a lot of women who, when they don't want to have children, They're like, oh, I don't want to have kids. And people press the issue and keep talking to them, like, say what's wrong with you, that's incredibly offensive, or even being asked is offensive. So in the PC culture that we exist in, do you think there's almost been this, you know, this fear of having these conversations because people don't want to come off as like nosy or offensive, even though they're incredibly important?
I think that's part of it. And one thing I advocate for in the book is don't be scared of the conversations and be curious about people and their goals and be curious about your own goals and have more open conversations with your partners and with your parents and with your doctors and with your friends. Because I feel like if we normalize the discourse, then we can achieve better solutions. So yes, I think there's a general discomfort with talking about these issues. And I feel like there have been such rapid changes over the last few decades in the way the genders relate to each other, in the aspirations that women can have. And I feel like our discourse hasn't totally caught up yet. So part of it is this conflict between traditional ways of talking about things and how we should be talking about them now that our realities have changed. And I feel like we can restart this conversation.
And have you found that the most effective way of starting the conversation is to just having it? I mean, do you have advice to give people who are grappling with these issues yet don't really know how to process them or deal with them effectively?
Well, first, I advocate for learning the facts yourself. There are great medical websites where you can find out the information. You can talk to your doctors. You can talk to your nurse practitioner. They might not have the answers, so then you might want to talk to a reproductive health specialist. But I encourage people to learn the fertility basics. And then I encourage them to share their stories, to just be open about their own opinions and experiences, and don't be scared to share it with others. And then I encourage people to ask questions. And I propose a number of questions. The whole last chapter is action items for the future, and I give advice for women of different reproductive ages. And I propose questions they can ask each other. And they're very basic questions, but it's just like opening up the dialogue so that we're not scared. And to have fun with those conversations too. It's like, do you want to be a mother? How do you envision that happening? How far are you willing to go to become a mother? Do you want to have a career? What kind of career do you envision for yourself? How do you think you can balance having a career and motherhood? How do you define happiness for yourself?
On your website, I'm just wondering, do you have like a forum for people to have these kind of conversations, or you do? Because I think that'd be great.
Well, I have a Facebook page. I haven't launched the forum yet on my website, which is www.thebigliebook.com. But there's a Facebook page for The Big Lie Book where people can have a conversation. And a number of people I know and people I don't know have been reaching out to me saying, you should see the conversations you're starting on their own Facebook pages when they've posted like an article or information about the book. Just the number of comments that go back and forth in these conversations. I mean, I think people want to talk about this stuff. And people have very strong, emotionally loaded and subjective points of view of this on these issues. And all those points of view are valid. And I'm just glad that the conversations are starting. And one other thing I'm going to do is I've created a toolkit, like an educational toolkit, that I'm going to launch on my website mid-February. And in that, I have some of these things we've been talking about, like the facts and quotes that people should be aware of regarding their fertilities, conversation starters, discussion topics, and also resources. Resources if you're looking for information about adoption, about fertility treatments, fertility treatment financing, and feminism.
I mean, I think that's incredibly important, and I'm so glad that you said that so people understand where they can go to have these resources. One last thing that I wanted to ask you about is just, you know, this issue is incredibly primal, and it's dealing with like the very fundamental aspect of it is what it is to be human and what it is to be a woman. And did you feel, or were you coming across women who had these issues with fertility that felt less than, or felt like they were failing, or it really impacted their identity because, or were they depressed? And what kind of advice would you give to them to, you know, not feel these like incredibly negative emotions about something that ultimately they can't do anything about? You know, they didn't fail, but I mean, how do you comfort women that are in that state of being?
Well, I found a range of emotions from happiness to depression along the motherhood spectrum for women who have kids and for women who don't. And one takeaway I got is that we are all in this boat together, and that if we speak with each other and don't judge each other, then we can work together to find solutions, because the solutions aren't easy, but we can start to advocate for them. And I think that we can get to a better place, because happiness is important. And the decision to have children or not is an important decision, and we cannot take it lightly. I mean, as you say, it's like so much about what it means to be a human, and it's also about our place in this world and what we leave behind. And, you know, in my own personal story, you'll find when you read the book, like, I end up not having a child, and now I'm 42 years old. Where am I at? And I feel like it's only been a year from the end point of my story in the book. I feel like I'm still healing. I don't know where my story is going to evolve. There are some people who are jumping on me and going to jump on me saying, well, why doesn't she just adopt? Or, you know, she can go and have a kid on her own. She can go to a sperm bank. I'm still processing the experiences that I've been through. And so I ask for the readers and the public to have some understanding of my situation and also of everyone's situation.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly it. These are incredibly personal decisions that people make, and they shouldn't be taken lightly. And I think that, you know, the beautiful thing about birth control and about the feminist movement and about all these fertility treatments is that there is the opportunity for women to be more empowered. And the way that we're going to achieve that, like you keep saying, is like through conversation and through education and being supportive of one another. So I think that Tanya's book is amazing. It's called The Big Lie: Motherhood, Feminism, and the Reality of the Biological Clock. Your website, thebiglyebook.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tony.